welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And I have Bruce here on my lovely Skype phone, which is always so much fun. And I believe you sent me a link last week to what we want to look at. So good morning, Bruce. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. Good. And yourself?
You know, I'm doing as as well as I can possibly be. And it's, you know, odd to say that because usually I'm just doing great. But it just seems like the last few weeks have just been incredibly difficult here at my house with my daughter becoming so incredibly ill.
Aww.
From this morning sickness, which is, I guess it's just sometimes it is just like life altering, which is what's happened with her, is that she is unable to go to work. She's unable to get out of bed. She's unable to, I mean, every smell makes her throw up. Everything is just making her, the whole world is being, her whole body is rejecting the world. And it's just incredible to see, but then also incredible to be a caregiver for someone who's in that situation, because it's almost like she's even more dependent than she was when she was a baby. You know, I see that when I'm, you know, helping her, I'm rubbing her back and, you know, trying to help her feel better. And, you know, I recognize, geez, when she was a baby, she couldn't tell me what she wanted. And so, you know, I recognize how many things I do that, you know, what I noticed when she was little, she would be very irritated by, but I didn't know why. And now as an adult, she's able to say, hey, you know, it really bugs me when you're, you know, you touch my elbow. You know, even to touch her elbow makes her just go insanely irritated. And she's just at this real sensitivity. And, you know, it's hard to understand why that is. Apparently the medical literature says it's a hormonal thing and it's protective for the baby, but boy, it sure is hell for the mom. So she hasn't been able to really eat or drink or anything for like 2 weeks. It's been a good almost 3 weeks, I guess. And she's been in the hospital twice, and she's been in the emergency room several times, and it's just you know, kind of wearing me down a little bit.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
So, you know, sleepless nights, sleepless days, you know, it's just very difficult. But also given me a tremendous, a tremendous practice.
Uh-huh.
Because as I am dealing with her, I am, you know, moving into a space where I'm actually able to see and feel how she feels. Uh-huh. And it's becoming connected in a way that, even as a mother with a baby, you don't become connected, because the baby is kind of an extension of yourself. And guess what? As a mother with her now, it's like she's still an extension of myself. Mm-hmm. And wow, I've had many, many, many interesting contemplations while sitting with her through this sickness. So where, you know, I you know, don't like that she's suffering, you know, I'm seeing a lot of things about myself and a lot of things that Jesus has explained to me in the Course in Miracles that I just really didn't even understand.
Yeah, yeah. I think we get these classroom opportunities at every moment, and sometimes it takes things that seem a bit more extreme to get our attention, that, you know, that we're all one thing and we're all interconnected, and it's all part of our learning to forgive what we dreamt up, isn't it? I mean, sometimes it can be pretty challenging.
Absolutely challenging. And, but, you know, obviously, you know, there's a purpose behind everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't have to try to guess what the purpose is. I already know what the purpose is.
Right.
You know, whether I understand the mechanism or not doesn't really matter. You know, the purpose is to heal my mind.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose is to show me the thoughts in my mind so that I can release them. I can look at them. I can recognize that I don't want them, and I can release them. So it's quite a it's a great classroom.
It is, yeah. And I had a conversation yesterday with Susan Dugan, and she's been going through a lot of things this past year with both her family and self, and I can, you know, I think we can all relate to, you know, these kind of things. And then we talked about how yesterday many of us were kind of watching and wondering and on a national and I suppose a global level, you know, what's going on and what seems to be sort of a crazy political situation in some respects. And it's just amazing how we get mirrors for what's in our unconscious mind. And that's usually the last thing our egos want to admit, but there are opportunities to look at our projections and to see in our saner, more lucid moments that these are calls for love. And no matter how cleverly disguised, they all are pleas for forgiveness from ourself to ourself, ultimately, even though it certainly seems anything but that, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. And you know, it's interesting. I kind of avoided all that because there was really no purpose of me paying attention to that when I had something here that needed to be looked at.
Sure.
And you know, that's that. You know, when do we start looking outside at other, you know, what's going on out there is, you know, when obviously, you know, we don't recognize that, hey, what's going on out there is what's going on in here. Mm-hmm. And I'm the one, you know, I'm the sole audience for this, You know, even though it seems like we're all suffering as a group and et cetera, no, I'm the only one. And, you know, I don't want to extend my suffering out to other people. You know, I want to look at what it is and why it is I'm deciding to be upset about it. Wow, it's like shades of the first, you know, lessons of the course right there. And it's good lessons.
Yeah. Interestingly, just as you said that, I was kind of flashed on something, a quote I hadn't really thought about for many years, but my mom used to tell me when I was a kid, something that's kind of stuck with me. And, I found it helpful. I think that was kind of a trigger for when I would have, times of depression years ago. I would kind of take this quote to heart and apply it to finding some way to be helpful to someone other than myself. And that used to always, and it still does. I don't really have a lot of problem with depression anymore, but I think largely from, you know, the practice of the course, that whole practice of shared interest and seeing that there's something, you know, beyond the seemingly separate self, I think is really the way out of it. And the quote what you just said reminded me of was, laugh, and you laugh together. I'm going to paraphrase this, I guess. And cry, and you cry alone. And I'm thinking, well, of course, that's sort of a paraphrasing of the ego's thought system. Is the self that the ego, the little s self that the ego promotes and propagandizes, and has a propaganda machine far more amazing and extensive and all encompassing than anything we can imagine by a, you know, political system in the world, promotes this idea that we're a separate self. We are on our own. You know, we don't have any help. You know, it's just the classic victimhood martyrdom paradigm. And that is really at the core of what A Course in Miracles is wanting us to look at very gently and with tremendous compassion, and to see that that's just a misunderstanding. It's not sinful, evil, or wicked. It's just silly. It's just a just kind of like going down, making a wrong turn, and spending, instead of 30 seconds in a cul-de-sac, lifetimes, you know, and realizing suddenly, oh, well, I could have driven out of that cul-de-sac any time just by turning the vehicle around instead of trying to ram into all the houses on that cul-de-sac, you know, try to getting out of there. you know.
Sounds like my neighbor.
Well, yeah. He has a dysfunctional approach to getting out of the driveway, huh?
And that's it, you know. And the quote is actually, laugh and the world laughs with you.
That's the one.
Cry alone.
Yeah, yeah, okay, okay. That's what it was. Yeah, exactly.
That's it. And it's true. But I don't know, because, you know, it seems like, you know, whatever it is that happens to be going on in my mind, there, I can always find someone to agree with me. And
Right.
Always.
Yeah, oh, of course. I think that analogy sort of breaks apart in that respect. But I think where it does hold is that the inclusion of the Holy Spirit is a joyous experience, ultimately. And that's how we feel at peace, whereas the ego's thought system is really pathetically sad, needlessly so. But it basically, even though it has allies, they're never really true friends, because it's really basically someone that commiserates with us, but we never. I don't think the ego really truly feels a genuine kinship or companionship. It's basically just, oh yeah, there's someone who agrees with me with my misery, but it's almost like everyone's digging a separate hole and we're just passing notes, you know, via paper airplane to each other in our respective holes. There's really no companionship there in our misery, a true companionship. Whereas if we can have compassion for each other, I think that's sort of like, instead of throwing down a shovel when we see someone in a hole, we hand them a rope ladder, you know, hopefully tied to
right.
a tree or something.
We don't jump in the hole with them.
Exactly, and especially we don't have to jump in the hole with them. Right?
And you know what? That's what I see with all these people who are so upset about the election and what's happening, is they're all jumping in the hole. And believe me, I tended to jump in that hole too, because I wanted to be a victim as well. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, that's not the purpose of any of this.
Exactly.
And the whole idea of my victimhood is the purpose. I mean, it really is just, you know, either, you know, I have a way of looking at the insanity in my own mind and deciding actively that I want to let it go and letting it go, or I can look at it and say, wow, this is pleasant. I'm in this hole and all these other people are in the hole. And then I just realized, I looked around and I said, oh, it's not just a hole. This is the pit for the outhouse. And, you know, we're all in this outhouse pit together, and
somehow I'm flashing on the scene from Slumdog Millionaire.
Yes, he
has to dive down through the outhouse at sort of this enormous cesspool to get to see his celebrity idol.
honestly, that's exactly what.
Which is actually a pretty interesting metaphor. I hadn't thought of it that way, but.
Yeah, well, you know, the world is full of them. I mean.
Yeah.
But not necessary and not helpful and not a place for a miracle worker. This is it. This is not a place for a miracle worker. And
Holy Spirit has better plans for us than the cesspool of the ego's thought system.
Yeah. Exactly. And it also reminded me of another story that, you know, I've heard often, and it's quite eloquent, is, you know, the village had a big well, and the donkey fell in the well.
Oh, yeah.
And the villagers all tried to get, they figured out how can they get the donkey out. They can't get the donkey out. So they decide, well, we'll just bury the donkey. And so they started throwing dirt in. And the donkey, you know, kept crying piteously. And, you know, they kept thinking, well, he surely should be buried by now. But they kept throwing more dirt in. And after a while, they'd thrown enough dirt in that it had filled up the well, and the donkey stepped out.
Mm-hmm.
The donkey.
And I think the mechanism by which he went beyond that challenge was he kept shaking it off. He kept denying the imagined intent of being buried alive. But which kind of reminds me of the classic Bob Newhart.
Bob Newhart.
Stop at skit. but I'm mixing metaphors there. But yeah, what the donkey was doing in that story, which is it's exactly what we need to do, is when those challenges, even if it's a dark night of the soul kind of experience, like it sounds like you might be been having recently with your daughter, you know, sometimes we get to those depths of you know, despair and discouragement. It's like if we can remember that there really is an awareness that was there before the experience and will be there after the experience that, you know, outlives it, we just keep shaking off and saying not no to ego's attempts to bury us. And then instead of using it to, you know, to be buried, we use it to climb out. And that's it's just a different purpose. Just kind of like a sailboat, you know. I remember there's a poem that's the set of the sails and not the gales that determines which way the ship goes, the kind of thing. And my first experience, I actually only was, you know, piloting a sailboat was. I rode on a sailboat in the Bay Area once, and it was kind of a neat experience. But the only time I've ever piloted one, a little small Hobie Cat kind of thing, up in a lake in Northern California, I remember being kind of amazed at the idea that you could actually go in a direction opposite the wind if you tack back and forth, but you actually use the energy of the wind, but you use it in a different direction so that you kind of go back and zigzag, but you're actually using the wind to go opposite the direction that it's blowing ultimately. And it's just a matter of choosing how you want to adapt to it. And I think the adaptation of the ego is always maladaptive, as Ken Wapnick points out brilliantly. And the adaptation of the Holy Spirit, a.k.a. our teacher of kindness within, is always, you know, this is not your true will. If you're not at peace, this isn't your true will. And you can choose to interpret the situation you think you're in, you know, and unfairly so, as a matter of choice. And once it's a matter of choice, then you can choose a different way of interpreting it.
And exactly.
That gets us out of the well. Yeah.
So here's a question, and I do have. I think we're going to look at question number 1256 today.
Uh-huh. That sounds good to me. If that works for you.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay.
But here's a question to me. Yes, I'm going to ask you my question. Do you now? This is going to sound fantastical to some folks, and maybe not, but. Doesn't it seem to you that, or it seems to me, let me just say it this way, it seems to me that what Jesus is implying to us throughout A Course in Miracles is that when I change my mind, the world changes with me. Mm-hmm. That is, if I could, and I've been encouraging people to do this, although I've been getting some resistance and some just outright you know, anger, to say, let us look at this man who has now become our president and look only to see the Christ in him, to look only to see the workings of the Holy Spirit through him, to see only that he is a character in the play, in the movie, and that who he truly is the Holy Son of God. And if I could give him that, which Jesus says these things over and over, give it to him. Give him his holiness. Give him his connection to God. If I could just give that to him, which, you know, I used to think, well, you know, I could just let him be. No, I have to actually give. I have to actually give it to him. That he is the Holy Son of God, that he is the Christ, and that if I could actually do that, then that would change everything. Not only would my mind change, but the character in the dream would be, you know, maybe acting in a different way, or, you know, supposing he did suddenly realize, oh, I'm the Holy Son of God, I'm the Christ. You know, I am not this mortal coil that calls itself Donald Trump. And what is my purpose here? Then the entire world would change. I mean, everything would change. Salvation would be accomplished. I do believe that. And so when I look at someone who appears to be such a incredible challenge, I recognize, well, this is for me. This is a gift mm-hmm. for me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
To be able to forgive and change everything, change the world.
Right.
And you know, not that I'm trying to change the world and I want to save the world from Donald Trump, although I do, you know, but the ego does. But because that's my instructions from my teacher is to do it this way, and it completely changes everything. So,
right.
You know,
and I think that's another good example of there's so many. I mean, everywhere we look, really, of the ego's attempt at level confusion, because I think the course is pitched always and only on the level of the mind. So what you just said is completely and totally correct, in that if we, in truth, see only this dazzling supernova of a sun, which we all are, and we all are as one being, oneself, that is going to ultimately pull us out of our misperceptions. But we have to also, at the same time, on the level at which we believe we are, not go into denial and look at what's happening. And I think, you know, again, within the dream of our projections, and it's very appropriate to make decisions on that level that relate to, you know, and again, it's a classic misperception, but our best judgment. But I think that can be a reflection of kindness to say, okay, I'm seeing the difference between a sun with a few clouds in front of it, or maybe a partial eclipse by the moon. I'm going to vote for that, instead of the near total eclipse. That was kind of the metaphor that came to me the other day. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the sun behind that isn't the same sun. It's just that we may have, you know, an experience of different amounts of eclipsing going on the level of form. That doesn't necessarily mean that the light behind it is any different. And I think that's what the Course tries to get us to remember. But we have to go through those clouds. We have to go through what our ego eclipses by looking at it and not denying its expressions or its manifestations. And I think this FAQ addresses that, is to deny our physical experience as a particularly unworthy form of denial. And I think that's where we get into a lot of trouble with level confusion, because it doesn't say, you know, don't serve on a jury because, you know, that means you would have to condemn. Well, it's not talking about condemning, and the level. It basically, the Course is always about the level of mind. So it's basically saying, yeah, you can agree that it might be best for a person to, you know, given the situation, serve some time in a correctional facility. Not that I have a lot of faith in those, but it, you know, if you know what I'm saying, it's basically not saying that, you know, don't do what's appropriate on a level of form. The Course is just saying, rather, train your mind to look at what's going on in terms of the level of condemnation in the mind, and recognize that is the denial of the truth that we're asked to look at with this curriculum. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, it does. And also, for me, recognize that it's not up to me. None
yes.
of it's up to me.
Yes, you know? Absolutely.
You know, if it was my responsibility to, you know, make, you know, somebody a different person, or somehow or the other, I had the capability to do it, or the desire to do it, which everyone has a desire, though, to make everyone else different. Never ever recognizing that the only way that I can make anybody else different is in my own mind.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
You know, and it all comes back to mind.
Yep.
But the, you know, that my opinion about your behavior, my opinion about your motives, my opinion or thoughts about your, you know, what is it that you're up to, and what, how can you harm me, and all those things, those are my stories. They have nothing to do with the reality of you, have nothing to do with the reality of me. It has only to do with the story in the illusion, in the dream. And, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in those stories believe that, and a lot of people get caught up in those stories and believe that their guidance.
Oh,
the Holy Spirit told me this and that, or told me to do this and that. Well, let me tell you something.
That's when Ken says, do not walk, but run as quick as you can from that kind of thinking. And I think there's, you know, a lot of precedent for that, because I think once we start saying, oh, that we're basically back to, you know, the problem with formal religion, which is basically, you know, and Christianity is just one example of countless of those, that where it's basically saying God is in the world, God is in the dream, and is going to fix the dream, and everybody should put their dream repair technician's hats on and you know, go fix the world. Well, that's not where the fixing is needed. Obviously, if we, as a result of really changing what needs to be changed, we feel a compassion or a sense of inspiration to do something that involves activism or you know, community involvement or whatever we're drawn to do. You know, in your case, you might be drawn to do something, you know, medically or you know, some health modality for your daughter, or it could be countless different examples that could be an expression of kindness that reflects a very peaceful, gentle awareness that there in truth is nothing wrong, and that we're all going through these dramas that have their ups and downs, and you know, that it appear, because that those appearances, like you were mentioning earlier, Lynn, is that, you know, our individual perceptions are intrinsically flawed, because we just see through this little tiny pinhole, just a tiny infinitesimal atomic wannabe speck in the cosmos, you know, a drop wannabe in the ocean, not even as big as a drop, and yet we think we've got the big picture, but obviously we don't. So that as gets demonstrated to us over and over again through so many ways, huh?
Well, and yes, it does. And, you know, Jesus tells us over and over and over, I don't know. I don't know. I do not see. I'm incapable of true vision. I'm incapable of looking at what appears to be another person and seeing the truth of what they are. Number one, because I wouldn't be seeing another person if I saw the truth of what they were, I would be seeing my own self.
Right,
you know, I would be seeing the truth of what I am. And so if I see anything other than that, then I'm seeing an illusion.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So why, you know, why would we, you know, like Don Quixote running around, you know, fighting windmills, you know, it's all illusions. They're not giants. They're not, they are, you know, they're nothing. And yet we have a quest to follow.
I know. And we're all Donald J. Quixote, aren't we?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're giving them the worst, you know, we're giving them the motivations. That's what cracks me up is,
right.
You know, what are his motivations? Whatever I give him, you know, whatever I decide they are. You know, I think he's motivated to destroy the country and turn us over to Russia. You know, that's my thought. You know, that I have no idea what his thought is or his motivation or his ideas, or, you know, he's thinking, you know, this is the greatest thing ever. And, you know, who's right? Nobody. You know, who's correct in this, any of it? None of us, because none of this is really happening. So, you know, it's like you're watching a movie and you're giving everybody their motives. That's motive is something that I think about a lot, is because I assign motives to people. I assume that they are thinking bad things, and I assign motives to them. You know, they're trying to do this, they're trying to do that. They're thinking this, they're thinking that. Who's the only one who's thinking?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Who's the only one?
Yeah, that brings up a good point, because I think And this was something in the conversation I had with Susan yesterday, Susan Dugan, that was something she said reminded me that really it can be simply distilled down to, you know, what Ken reiterated so many times in so many ways and eloquently, that it's just a matter of two thought systems that are completely consistent, but one of them is completely insane, and a decision-making faculty that chooses between the two of them. So the ego is 100% insane. Our inner kindness teacher's thought system, a.k.a. Holy Spirit, a.k.a. Jesus of the Course, that is completely sane. And moment to moment, we're choosing between those two thought systems. And that's what everyone is doing. So to try to guess what someone else's motivation is at any given moment is just like, you know, an engineering problem, a black box. We don't have any inputs and outputs to that black box. So we don't know what's going on. But we certainly know what we're projecting onto that. And that's what we need to be mindful of and cognizant of and see that that's our classroom. It's not the other, because there is no other. It's our projections. And if we're feeling discomfort, that's the clue that we need to drop the ego's sword and pick up the Holy Spirit's hand and lose the misinterpretation and gain the translation that everything is just an expression of love or a call for it, the truth.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And how easy it is for me to think that people are worthy of attack.
Yeah. Yeah.
That everyone is worthy of attack. Let me tell you again that when I find myself attacking, which I mean, it's shocking to me, Bruce, because you know, how long have I been doing this work? And even before I was doing A Course in Miracles, I was, you know, fully into, this Tibetan Buddhism. You know, I had all these, you know, ideas and thoughts about the world and about all this cosmology, and all of it was based on trying to be kind to other people and to have to help alleviate suffering through that kindness, through that goodness. And yet I was doing exactly the opposite all the time. And I find myself, even as a Course in Miracles student, doing exactly the opposite of what Jesus is asking me to do. And every single time, it is an attack. Yeah, and I'm justifying it through this idea of morality, this idea of right and wrong, this idea of, you know, he's kind and she's not, and, you know, he's a crook and she's a saint. Or every time I assign any motivation to anyone, I'm attacking them. I'm saying, this is not the Son of God. Mm-hmm. This is a intruder in the kingdom. You know, let's get this snake out of here. It don't work that way.
another opportunity for level confusion. You know, it may be that in a few weeks, the new administration delivers on their promises in a way that's helpful, and you know, could be a big surprise to a lot of people. And I'm not holding my breath particularly, but you know, without getting into a whole political conversation, it also seems that it may be very appropriate to mobilize for massive impeach the whole cabinet in short order. But that can be done without judgment and without condemnation, just an acknowledgement of a dispassionate awareness that okay, here's a reflection of an immature thought system. I think that's where there was I think I mentioned this in a previous conversation we had that years ago. I heard this conversation about the Aramaic translation of the Bible, and the word sin evil. One of those was basically in the Aramaic, it actually meant unripe, as in immature.
Wow.
And I thought that's kind of a cool understanding, because that's exactly what Jesus how he describes us in this curriculum of his. He says, you're you're infants. And Ken says, we're probably not even there yet. we're pre-infancy, basically. Yeah. And I think that can be really helpful, is that if we look at the infantile behavior of some of these over-the-top poster children that basically remind us that that's what the ego is. It has no maturity whatsoever because it is impossible of maturity. So it's intrinsically unripe, but you don't throw a banana away because it's unripe. You patiently wait for it to ripen, you know? Usually that works. The metaphor kind of falls apart there, because I've thrown away some green bananas that have been green for weeks and weeks, you know. But you know, normally, you know. But I think that's, you know, a good reminder that, you know, we're all just children when it comes to the Course. We're all so versed and so invested in an identity that's, you know, at the bottom rung of the ladder, that's convinced that condemnation and judgment is the way out of its own self-made hell, that it really doesn't know anything else. And we haven't really tried, you know, the curriculum very much. We understand it intellectually, but the head to the heart distance, as Ken quoted someone else, I can't remember what it was, but it's basically saying that's, you know, the longest distance between the head to the heart is basically realizing that our compassion, which is what you've been addressing all morning in this conversation, Lynn, is really crucial and vital to ourselves and each other in order to, you know, go beyond the eclipse and see the light that's there. One quick, story that from Absence from Felicity that Ken tells about Helen that I think is pertinent to all of us. And Helen was complaining about, you know, midway or some partway somewhere describing the Course is, you know, how difficult it was. And Jesus's comment, you know, in some of the notes apparently, is, well, have you ever considered that, you know, you haven't really tried it? You know, I'm paraphrasing that, of course, again. If I run across that in Absence from Felicity, I'll have to post it somewhere. But I thought it was good. Is, you know, basically, you know, kind of like almost this tongue in cheek, you know, like, gee, you know, maybe if you actually tried the curriculum, you'd find that it works, you know. But I think, you know, our resistance is so great that we don't realize that. And I noticed this in myself, you know, when the TV comes on and my favorite shows are lampooning politicians most of the time, because I guess I enjoy a little comic relief, but at the same time, you know, in the conversation yesterday, we were talking about how, you know, a lot of our, what we call entertainment is really, unless we're mindful, at someone else's expense. It's basically looking at our own projections, forgetting that they're that, and then condemning the seeming other to perpetuate the hellish thought system of differences that just keeps us miserable. And that's just silly, isn't it?
It is just silly. And you know how Jesus keeps telling us, you're doing it to yourself.
Exactly. Should we dive into the FAQ?
Yes, let's do that. Yes, okay. Yes, yes. All right. I'll read.
Okay.
We're on number 1256, and I did post in the room, so anybody who wants to go there can go and listen and read along. So, question number 1256. I have read the text of A Course in Miracles and will be starting the lesson soon. Wow, what a nice orderly thought system. I am feeling an increase in depression and health concerns. Having been a spiritual student for several years, I know that the body is just an illusion, and that we are in control of our thoughts. But I feel I will never achieve peace. Sometimes I feel so angry and depressed that I wonder, why bother? I feel very desperate for help. Okay, now which one of us asked that question?
All of us, moment to moment to moment, yeah. So I love the beauty of these the frequently asked questions that are on the facimoutreach.org website, because they're always so relatable, even if it's not something that we're specifically going through. There's usually someone we know that's had some similar experience, and again, this is the ego always likes to make exceptions. So these questions inexorably lead back to the thought system of the Course. the answers do, and I think they're beautifully, crafted answers and inspired, writing that gives us reminders to complement the course that show that you can take any seemingly practical question or conundrum and use the principles and the ideas and the philosophy and the awareness that is behind the words in the course to return to that awareness in the mind. So I'll read the first answer of the paragraph to this FAQ number 1256.
All right.
The state you describe, knowing that ultimately our own thoughts determine our experience, but still at times finding ourselves mired in depression and anger, is undoubtedly very familiar to many spiritual students. Ironically, the knowledge that we do not have to be miserable often heightens our awareness of just how miserable we are. I think that's really an important – I'm going to pause just to comment on that one just for a moment, because I think that's really an important principle is that kind of normal scenario, because it's only when we start noticing the contents of our mind that we see that we're in a swamp. You know, if we're busy decorating the dumpster, we're not going to pay much attention if we're focused on the flowers and that we put up on a little shelf and the paintings that, and the little spotlights that we've added to take our attention away from the fact that, we're in this really rank, smelly dumpster, but that's what the ego tries to do. It tries to find little blooms in the desert and focus on that and make that the big deal and make those special and make all the sand the evil stuff and that this were these little, helpless flowers, at the mercy of the desert winds and the drought or the monsoons or whatever. But it's, whatever, pick your metaphor. But I think it's important to remember that once we start noticing the contents of our mind, very often it seems like there's this ego backlash. But I think more accurately, it's like that ego insanity has been there all along. It's just we just weren't paying attention to it. And it only seems like suddenly we're more miserable.
Right.
I think if we're honest and look back at our past, we realize if we realize are honest with ourselves, there really hasn't been a time in our lives where we've been truly consistently happy all the time. That's basically an ego myth for nostalgia. And there's several workbook lists that go over that, like the one that talks about the little child wanting to go home but we never were home in the world. Another favorite quote is, if this were the real world, God would be cruel, because the ego's world is a one of cruelty, but that's not the world that the Course wants us to return to. Okay.
Exactly. Just to also mention that it appears to me right now that the things that make me sad or unhappy just seems so much more sharp and painful and not muted. I think that's what has happened is that before there was just so much. Right. It was just so terrible that, even the tiniest little bit of sunshine, like if you're in a dark, dark cave and there's a little beam of light, it seems like everything. But now that you're closer to the light, any little bit of darkness is like torture.
Right.
And that's, it's like all comparison. It's all comparison. So, any time in your life that you're ever truly happy, well, first off, it's impossible for the ego to feel joy. Mm-hmm. It is impossible for the ego to feel happiness. Even any time that you thought you were happy in the past and you look back and you recognize, oh, geez, that was only in comparison to the misery that I had been experiencing, that was just a little bit of a relief or a rays of sunshine.
Right.
But, now it's to the point where any bit of darkness is like the most horrible thing that could happen. And, you know, I was thinking the other day, oh my gosh, you know, all this work I've done, and I keep saying it, you know, and look at, I'm still suffering. And it almost seems worse now. But the fact is that, you know, recognizing that suffering for what it is a huge, huge gift. And, so I'm grateful, grateful for those circumstances.
Yeah. And that gratitude, I think, comes from the infinite reservoir that is a non-dual gratitude, which is, if I can make up a phrase, that is what the Course, I think, really is leading us back to, which has nothing to do with the comparative gratitude of, oh, now there's a lull in the battlefield and, you know, I can, you know, lower my sword and my cat of nine tails and maybe lift the visor on my suit of armor, you know, momentarily for a breath of air, you know. It's kind of a, you know, the sort of Damocles thing is that you know that the next onslaught of warriors from over the hill is, you know, inevitable when you're on the battlefield and you've got your military garb, you know, on kind of thing. It's only when we shift teachers and get above the battleground altogether that we can have lasting peace and gratitude that isn't just, oh, I'm better off than so-and-so or I'm feeling better than I did, you know, the other day or a few years ago or whatever, or I wish I felt better like I did a few years ago or the other day or whatever. You know, all those comparative things really never truly, that happiness that the Course is addressing. I think that's something that inspires me. Is like the peace that the Course leads us to is so transcendently profound that we don't even have a clue. You know, and like the Course says, a tranquil mind is not a little gift. And I don't think we really have a complete sense of what that tranquil mind really is, because we've been so enmeshed in battle and in the battle of the ego of trying to fight against our real self.
Yeah. And what happens is, you know, we get above the battleground, we find a little bit of peace, we decide, you know, that, you know, this is, I'm feeling better now. And what do? We go back to the battleground.
Right, right.
You know, we keep going back to the battleground thinking, now I can go back and win this thing. Now I can go back and fix this thing. You can never do anything. It's impossible to change anything from that level. Really, you got to stay above the battleground.
Yeah.
And that's very difficult.
And that's why it's a course that doesn't ultimately involve any kind of compromise, because they're in truth, which is, you know, a pure non-dual awareness, there is no other. So there's no opposite to truth. But our perception is that there is. But anyway, it's kind of getting into a more arcane metaphysical arena. But it's really, I think, the foundation of the courses and, you know, awareness that, you know, we really don't have to be miserable. But we have to work through seemingly are the things we haven't forgiven in order to get there. Should I continue?
Continue.
Okay, it says, I'll just reread the last sentence. It says, ironically, the knowledge that we do not have to be miserable often heightens our awareness of just how miserable we are. In addition, it is likely that the idea of beginning the workbook is extremely threatening to your ego. As the Course says, the ego will attack your motives as soon as they become clearly out of accord with its perception of you. This is when it will shift abruptly from suspiciousness to viciousness, since its uncertainty is increased. Like, I think I would say that it's always uncertain, but our awareness of its uncertainty becomes, you know, spotlighted. So perhaps you can take some comfort in the fact that yours is a common reaction to trying to achieve spiritual growth. It is not a symptom of weakness or a sign of failure on your part. So I think that can be really helpful to not be discouraged when the inevitable ego backlash happens when we start being more mindful and we don't get blindsided by the ego's, you know, counterattack strategy of saying, oh, yeah, you're gonna lose this individual self and replace it with something I have no concept of. Well, y'all, we'll see about that.
And really, this kind of points to also this idea of somehow linear progress.
Right.
That,
right.
You know, if I can do this, then I can do that. Then I can do this, then I can do that. Then I can, you know, and if I can't do this, then I have to go back to square one. And, you know, this is not a linear process at all.
Mm-hmm.
Although it seems so, because it seems to kind of go along, you know, I liken it to, you know, going on train on a track, and you're just going chugga, 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 chugga. You're just on the train on the track, and you'll stay on that track for ever and ever and ever, because, you know, just going around and around in that horizontal thinking. And what Jesus tells us is, you know, the miracle is the shift from that horizontal thinking to the vertical. Where right, instead of going chugga chugga, you're like suddenly going like a rocket ship, bing, straight up.
Yep.
And so, you know, once you get off the track and start, you know, going to that vertical thinking, which is above the battlefield, then you have that proper connection. You have the bottom line to all of this is that connection to our Christ nature through the miracle. And that connection puts us into the holy instant. And in that holy instant, then all these choices are not, they don't even, there's nothing to choose. You know, in the holy instant, you're just there. And, you know, you've gone vertical, and having gone vertical, now you have, you don't have to, you're off the track completely.
Mm-hmm.
But we think we need to keep going on the track. You know, we think to make progress, we need to keep going on the track. And I need to do these lessons. I need to read this book. I need to, you know, and, you know, the whole purpose of those is to tell you, no, you don't. You know, this is it. If you can just leap out of this horizontal thinking into this Christ-minded, holy instant thinking, then be not even thinking, you're being. And when that happens, then all the rest of this is inconsequential. And you can actually be truly helpful then. You can actually be truly helpful because you're not, you know, you're not in the well with the rest of the villagers.
Right,
you're not
right.
in the porta potty or whatever. You're actually, you know, somewhere where you can be of help. But you don't go there because you intend to be of help, because the only one you're helping is your own self. So again, as Jesus points out here, the ego will attack your motives. Again, it's this idea of what it is that I'm doing and what is the purpose of what I'm doing. And, once you recognize that the purpose really is to be truly helpful, the purpose really is to align with the Christ mind and to be one with my Father and my brothers, then all the rest of this, you know, does criticizing the government go along with that particular motive on my part? No. Does, you know, being upset about what Jim said to me, is that part of my, is this something that is going to be helpful? No. You know, you just recognize, well, that's obviously not true, not real, it's not helpful. And, you know, how helpful it is to me to be, you know, being upset about Donald Trump is zero. In fact, it's negative. It's like, I'm going back in the hole. to be taking this up, but it really, it's just what's been on my mind. And I think that, you know, it does represent some little bit of progress, because this quote is talking about an abrupt shift also from mm-hmm. suspiciousness to viciousness. And that's the abrupt shift you go into if you don't go for the holy instant, if you don't align yourself with your true teacher. So.
Yeah. And I think in addition to what you just said, I think it's important to remember that when we do things in the world thinking that we're somehow going to fix the world, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's no different than brushing your teeth or paying the bills that come in or doing anything, you know, a normal person would do. It's just the why. If we can look at the why we're doing it, and you know, gradually take the anxiety and the fear out of our motivations, and not by trying to you know, dismantle the ego, because it's not going to be dismantled. It's just going to be transcended. I think we need to, you know, using your vertical analogy, it's really by looking at it without condemnation that we slowly but surely stop identifying with it. And then, you know, at those moments of clarity, it's sort of like, you know, again with the vertical metaphor, instead of going through this circuitous labyrinthine maze, like a rat looking for cheese, and the ego's always pulling the cheese a little bit farther around the next few bends so that we never really are satisfied. You know, the Holy Spirit basically says, well, climb up one of the walls and you can see that A, you're in a maze, and B, you can see the quickest path by hopping across the walls, you know, to get out of there, or not even bother with the maze, and just, you know, you can, you know, find what you're looking for above the maze.
Kind of thing. And realize that you've never been away from your cheese.
Exactly.
My cheese has been here the whole time.
Or baby cheeses.
Baby cheeses has been here the whole time. Oh, I love it. Oh my God.
Can I read the next one?
Okay. If you are feeling desperate for help, seek that help in whatever form you think would be most effective for you right now. For example, do not hesitate to get medical or psychological assistance if that would alleviate your health concerns and depression. It is true that real healing comes exclusively from the miracle or change of perception that occurs in the mind, and it is the only thing that can lead us to lasting inner peace. But as long as we retain any guilt or identification with ourselves as the separated physical beings we seem to be, we do not want to deny ourselves physical or psychological comfort. Comfort. I love that word. While Jesus does label attempts to solve problems where they are not, for example, in the world, as magic, nowhere does he say not to do this. In fact, he tells us that to deny the existence of the world or the body is a particularly unworthy form of denial. And we all know that from chapter 2, section 4. What we're looking for and what anyone is looking for. It doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter what you're doing, or what you think your motive is. What you're really looking for is peace.
Right.
What you're really looking for is to feel okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what everyone is looking for. Exactly.
Yes.
The peace can't be changed.
Yep. And to recognize that that's all anybody wants. Mm-hmm. You're right. Mm-hmm. You know, even that can be helpful to recognize that, you know, the Donald is not being a bad guy because he wants to hurt people. You know, he's doing what he thinks is going to be the best thing. You know, he doesn't really know how, but he's trying. Just like anybody else, you know, Obama didn't know how. He was just trying. He was doing what he thought was best. I don't see any difference, and this is going to shock people, I don't see any difference motivation-wise between either of them, because I don't see any difference motivation-wise between any of us. We're all trying, we're all swimming in the same sewer.
Mm-hmm.
We're all trying to get someplace where we are safe and comfortable.
Right. And I think this paragraph addresses, again, the magic thoughts, which isn't to say, you know, it's basically saying, you know, nowhere does he say not to do this. So, you know, extrapolating that to, you know, the political paradigm, if we feel, you know, as an activist motivated to participate in a women's march or a political, organization of some sort to maintain what we think is appropriate, government systems or whatever we feel, you know, and for environmental or ecological or social reasons or, you know, whatever we feel motivated to do, there's nothing wrong with doing that. It's just that if we make it about a we, they paradigm, and can watch our minds, that's the emphasis that the Course is always leading us back to, is to just look at the why, look at the motivation without condemnation, and just see where the ego gets us, and just notice dispassionately how it never is fulfilling. But it doesn't say not to do it. It just says just notice how this never makes you happy.
Yeah. And the big part of it is that what you're doing when you do these things, whether you recognize it or not, again, is an attack. It is saying, you know, I don't like what you're doing. I want you to do something else. I think that you are a nefarious character. I'm worried about the future. You know, all of that thinking is an attack. And when I am doing that, what is it making me feel? What do I feel when that happens? Guilt, 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 guilt. That's the only way that the ego knows how to deal with being, if I attack, if I defend myself, I'm attacked. If I attack, attack is never justified. Why? Because it does bring about this feeling of guilt, whereupon I'm attacking myself. And guilt is the motivation for keeping maintaining this world and avoiding our true self and true nature. You know, we're all trying to get over this guilt. And why do we feel uncomfortable? Because guilt is painful. You're never going to feel happy. You'll never feel comfortable if you are seeing and experiencing guilt.
Yep, yep. That's it. That's it. I mean, because as long as we're working within a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem, thinking that that's going to do it for us, you know, we're not going to be at peace. But again, like this paragraph suggests, and it addresses level of confusion very nicely. It's not saying don't be politically active, don't do something on the level of form for your body or your family or your community or your nation or your planet. It's not saying anything like that. It's saying just the opposite. It said basically be normal, because that's going to lead you away from fear. Because if you don't do the normal thing for what's you know comfortable for you, physically or psychologically, as it points out, you're probably going to plunge deeper into fear. You know, so you know, do what you feel inspired to do, but be mindful and watch what moments you're honestly motivated by fear, and what moments you're motivated by love. And that's really simple, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I can almost guarantee you, and this is probably controversial too, but I can almost guarantee you, if you're motivated by love, you're not going to do anything other than, you're not going to go marching. You think you're supporting people with your marching. You think you're given a message when you're marching. No, you're just attacking. You're attacking your own self by looking outward, looking externally for the cause, looking externally for the guilt. And, you know, I'm not saying don't go march if you feel like it. Don't vote if you feel like it. I'm just saying look at why you're doing it. And then look at how it's making you feel. And you might come away from that march all bloated up with joy and everything because you think you've made a point. But you're deep inside, you know that all you're doing is attacking your brother and yourself by protesting or supporting. Either way.
Yeah, and we really don't know, do we? Because no. There may be people involved in things that we think, you know, from our little on the battleground perspective, well, that any behavior that looks like this is you know ego motivated, and the converse, you know. But we don't know. I mean, because there may be people who are doing things that on the surface seem to be contrary to you know essentially behavior inspired by something that, you know, we don't agree with or that we do agree with, but we don't really know at any given moment. So that's why the Course is so insistent, gently, that we don't judge on the basis of form. And ultimately we just, you know, stop judging altogether because based on the interpretations of the dream we made up and hand those interpretations over to our inner kindness teacher for reconstruction and you know, reassignment. I'll read the next paragraph.
Okay,
emotional
ahead.
Ups and downs and endless concerns and pains are inevitable for bodies. Indeed, we dreamed up this world precisely to be in a constant struggle that obliterates God's love from our mind. So we cannot expect our issues to subside easily. Feeling guilty or frustrated that we still have them is not a helpful or kind thing to do to ourselves. What is helpful is to realize that our pains are the very curriculum that the Holy Spirit can use to teach us that we are not the victim of the world we see. For that to happen, we need to ask Him to hold our hand and look at our pain with us without judgment. He will teach us that our troubles merely indicate that our intellectual understanding of the illusory nature of the world and the body are still overshadowed by our fear. There's the clouds that seem to blot out the sun that eclipse it. And fear calls for love and understanding, not punishment. And that's what you've been saying all morning, Lynn, is this, that whether it's a political figure or a daughter having morning sickness or, you know, any circumstance, it makes no difference what we're involved in. The only appropriate response is love and kindness and to not condemn ourselves when we don't make that response, you know, when we're choosing against that peace.
Right. Loving kindness for all.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, it's a lot there. I think for us to ponder and to implement, isn't there?
Exactly. I mean, this is the whole course right here.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Honestly, if you could just get this, I think this anyway, and not, you know, I think highly of my own my own progress. I'm sorry. If you could just get this though, that you know, everything I do it to myself,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not the victim. If something is happening in my world, it's not because, you know, I'm somehow or the other being attacked or overwhelmed. It's because I've chosen these things to show me what and how and why I'm operating the way I am. You know, I've chosen these things to make it clear that this is not the world. This is not the real world. This is not what God made. You know, I remember the incredible relief, as I'm sure you probably did too. I don't know, a lot of people reading Disappearance of the Universe and recognizing, oh, God didn't do this to me. God didn't do this. And, you know.
That is a huge relief, isn't it? And that ties in beautifully with, you know, the quote I shared earlier, if this were the real world, God would be cruel, because I think that basically is the ego strategy, is, which of course is insane, is to lead us to believe that somehow there could be an insane world that was, you know, made by a sane creator. It's like, what? How could that be? You know, why would God be schizophrenic and make up something that's sometimes seemingly, you know, tolerable and other times intolerable? And it's like, well, what, why would that make sense? I mean, why would there, how could a right. schizophrenic God make any kind of sense other than in an insane dream, an ego dream?
Exactly. You just got to say, what was you thinking, God?
Yeah, what were you thinking?
What were you thinking?
that really is, I think, the true hope, you know, and to tie into the, you know, the political transition of week, you know, where I enjoyed President Obama's farewell address, where he talked about hope, and I was thinking, well, on the level of form and truth, you know, which kind of ties in what you were saying, Lynn, is there really is no hope in the world. But I translated that farewell address in a different level. It's like, well, the hope that we really all have is the hope that we return to our minds, see that we're all one being, and forgive any residual evidence to the contrary that is part of our script. We hired these actors. We paid for these props to be put in place and this elaborate set design that we call the universe, and not on a level we're consciously aware of, but we invested in this in massive classroom situation as a response to the tiny mad idea. That was our investment, our way out of the dream, and we all paid for it. But it's not a prison. It's a classroom seen properly, and it can be a joyous one.
Yes, it can. And what brings about the joy is to recognize, oh, God didn't do this, and I'm doing it to myself, which sounds like something that would make me condemn myself, because I'd be going, what the heck am I doing? But, you know, just recognizing, oh, you know, it's just a little game. It's just something that, you know, I have decided I prefer to see rather than peace.
Yep.
And to recognize that I prefer to see this instead of peace, I also have to not feel guilty about that as well.
Right.
Because that can bring about a tremendous amount of self-condemnation, you know, when you recognize I'm doing it to myself. And so there's got to be this balance where, you know, I recognize I'm doing it to myself, but I also recognize that it's nothing. Nothing has happened and nothing is happening. And, you know, it's just I walked into this movie theater to watch this Texas Chainsaw Massacre instead of walking into the next door movie theater and watching Cinderella. And, you know, recognizing too that both Cinderella and Texas Chainsaw Massacre are the same content, mm-hmm. whether they appear to be different or not. They're the same
content. Special love and the special hate are the same, even though they seem to be light years apart, huh?
Exactly. So, you know, recognize I'm the one who decided to come into the movie theater. I'm the one that decided to go to, you know, cereal. You know, these modern conveniences we have really have brought a lot of great analogies to us for, you know, the, what we're doing to ourselves. Because, you know, when you're in that theater and you're in that darkness and you're walking around and you're eating that popcorn and, you know, this is a great experience. You know, I can go from theater to theater to theater and watch lots of different movies and have lots of different experiences. But eventually I'm going to step out of that theater into the sunshine or into the not bright night or whatever and breathe the fresh air and recognize, oh, that was a dream. That was, none of that was really happening. And, you know, the more I can remember that there is something outside of this theater and it is a truth and reality and I'm the one who's deciding to stay in here and go watching all these different movies, you know, eventually I will want to step out into that, the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then no more special movies. It's just all just one thing.
And I think we ease that transition back to, you know, unchanging peace by recognizing the shared interest that we all have and by gently looking at our minds moment to moment and over time consistently choosing less and less insanity and an identification with that insane thought system and being very gentle with ourselves.
Yes, being gentle with ourselves. Which is the hardest thing to do when you know that you should know better.
And of course, that knowing is with a little K, you know, it's you know, that's usually a condemnation implied there with that know better kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. There's a motive and a judgment
mm-hmm.
that goes on with that. Yeah.
The knowing that the Course is talking about has nothing to do with condemnation.
That's right. That's right. And once you really know, then you can't condemn. You cannot condemn. So I'm going to go ahead and start the next paragraph, and okay. I might read the next two, the last
sure,
two.
Sure. Why
okay.
not?
Okay, this then is the answer to why it is worth continuing on the spiritual path, even when it feels as though we are not getting anywhere, by realizing that the Holy Spirit's non-judgmental love is in our mind, right alongside our fear. We discover that our insanity has no effect on God's love. In this way, our fear and pain gradually lessen and begin to lose the power they seem to have over us. They may not disappear for quite some time, but they slowly cease to be a big deal. Eventually, every time we feel pain, we can simply look at it and say, there it goes again. So what else is new? And whoa, what a relief. And, you know, I think about myself as other students of a course, and I look at, oh, you know, he's been studying the course for 4 years and he's still pissed off about this. And, you know, why do they, you know, they teach the course and yet they can't forgive this thing, you know, there it goes again. So what else is new?
Mm-hmm.
When I see that it is me who is doing that and no one else, even though they appear to be a big blustery character or they appear to be a, something else that I couldn't possibly be, when I see it and I recognize that, whoops, I did it again. So what else is new? So what? That's what Vicky Poppy says. So what? Then you can relax. And so until we reach that point, when we catch ourselves thinking that our pain is a miserable ending point rather than a silly temporary roadblock, we can remember Jesus' loving advice. And this is from text chapter 23, the war against yourself. The ego always marches to defeat because it thinks that triumph over you is possible. And God thinks otherwise. Yay! Oh, my gosh. Dove has been playing that Ken Wapnick workshop, and God thinks otherwise.
Oh,
and, wow, it's so helpful. And God thinks otherwise. What a wonderful, wonderful phrase. And that's from text chapter 23.
Neat stuff. Neat stuff. Yeah, yeah, because that's really the very helpful, soothing awareness that no matter how, and I think this FAQ addresses it really nicely, no matter how crazy or how challenging our current circumstances are, there is an awareness that is calmly watching everything that seems to be happening in the world and is able to counsel us to not take it quite so seriously, not make it a big deal, not get all upset and troubled over the things that can come and go, and that's when we remember that our true identity exists not as big as the universe, but bigger than the entirety of space-time, and that's true for all of us, and that we really are this essence that transcends the ephemeral, that is beyond the dream, because anything that can change must be a dream. And I think that's the conclusion we ultimately reach and then gently step away from it. We just basically say, okay, I'm going to climb up this ladder and get on top of the maze and then just say, yeah, maybe I really don't need to be traversing this maze. I can, get beyond that and return to the comfort that doesn't change. And that's our heritage, and ultimately what we never left. But we're just having this massive, seemingly multi-lifetime, or however many years or whatever we think it takes to undo the tiny mad idea.
Yeah, and none of that is that multi-lifetime thing. These eons and billions of years and billions of stars and billions of, all of that is really not, it's nothing at all. Everything is only happening in this very moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if I think, I was, lived and suffered and lived and suffered. And I have had this guy contacting me, which just is really amusing to me, but it's not amusing to my husband. But this guy has been contacting me and saying that I was his wife in the past life, and he wants me back. And excuse me. And he lives in India. yesterday, you know, he said, I want you to come to my home. I'm like, you know, I don't have money to go to India. What the heck? You know, even if I did, I wouldn't be coming to see you. I have a husband already. And, you know, I really don't want more than one. And sometimes don't even want that. But just joking. But anyway, you know, it's like, you know, he's convinced of a story that I know never happened. And, you know, it's like I tell him, you know, this may be your thought. You may have an idea that I was your wife in another life. And you know, that's a good story for you, I guess. But, you know, my story is I've never been in another life. This is the only life I have, and this is the only life I know. And if I have stories, those are things that I made up. You know, that's none of that's real. The only thing that's real is what's happening now. And so why would I want to go back into some story world? I don't. But how easily people get caught up in it, and of course it's the ego that is fascinated by its own mechanism. So of course it's going to convince me of all sorts of fantastical stuff. You know, and then people who are listening are probably thinking, well, yeah, but you know, I remember this life and that life. Yeah, we remember everything, honey. The entire story, the entire script, we wrote it. How could you not remember it? And the only reason you don't remember it is because you've distanced yourself through guilt from the thing that you made up and the thing that you believe is true. And so make it seem that it's happening to you, not coming from you.
I kind of like the harkening back to, I think it was actually from Richard Bach's movie Illusions, perhaps, or somewhere in that era when I was reading that anyway, that came across the idea that, you know, the entire movie in the old, you know, celluloid. That's the word I'm looking for.
celluloid.
Film reels, like we used to get in grade school. You know, the whole movie's in that can, you know, or in the case of more contemporary technology, it's on the thumb drive and on the server and in little bits of ones and zeros. It's all there at the same time. It's just that in order for us to experience the illusion of time, we need to, you know, as you were alluding to earlier, Lynn, play it in a linear fashion so that it gives us an incredibly convincing realism of a holographic experience that is really just a dream, but it's in a distortion of the fact that, you know, we're just looking at one frame or one you know, holographic projection of an infinite series or seemingly infinite series of frames at a time. But it's a movie. It's a movie. And if we can remember that, and if, you know, it's a dream. If we can keep that in mind and just not make such a big deal out of it, and do the things that we think we need to do in the dream, whether it's medical, political, social, environmental, whatever, you know, just help ourselves to the whatever magic, you know, is we find comforting, as this FAQ suggests, and then allow ourselves to move more quickly past the fear that way, then, you know, we can start to become aware of that identity that we all share, that capital S self that is nothing but peace, that is nothing but true comfort, the true. I think it's interesting that the word sooth, you know, the old English forsooth, you know, for is really for truth, and then that's really what is ultimately soothing is the truth.
Wow.
The only thing that's truly comforting is the truth. But because it doesn't change, anything else truly is not going to soothe us or comfort us. Anything that can possibly change or be, you know, gained or lost, can be born or die. And that's why bodies are ego's poster child, because they come and go. But the spirit is eternal, and that's us. That's the real us.
That's a real us. And I love that, you know, the soothe, because, you know, it soothes us. Wow, the truth soothes. But yeah, this holding on to this identity that, thinks that it's capable of being attacked and that it's actively being attacked, that keeps me in a state of fear. And that state of fear is this is where the ego is just in its glory. Mm-hmm. It's in charge completely. And so noticing.
It's actually gory, not glory, but it likes to throw the yell in there.
I like that, yes. But recognizing that, every single bit of that is something that I'm choosing and letting go of it without condemning myself for it, just recognizing, hey, it's just a silly thought, mm-hmm. just a tiny mad idea.
Yeah.
I don't have to, I can have peace instead of, I can see peace instead of this. You could just read the titles of the first, 50 lessons, and you would have the entire philosophy of A Course in Miracles right there. Mm-hmm. And it's the thing that tells you every time what to choose, because recognize that I'm constantly choosing. And so, if I have a choice and I want to say, oh, I'm afraid of this man who's now our president or, Secretary of Energy or any of these things, then I'm choosing against peace. I'm choosing against sooth, the truth. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be unhappy and I'm going to be agitated and I'm going to be wanting to act and react. If I choose only for the truth and reject what isn't, then not reject it, just for the heck of it, but reject it because I recognize that it's not the truth and it's not helpful. And there's no reason for me to believe it. Then I can find peace, and being in peace then makes me an effective, everything in this world. I can walk through the world like Jesus, like the Christ. Although it seemed like he agitated a lot of people, but it was he himself was not agitated, and he was not in fear, and he was in peace. And I'm sure that that shook people up to be around someone like that if they were believing that guilt and fear was the most important thing. So recognize that you might be scaring people too. If you're very peaceful and it's
it's really scaring the ego, isn't it? I mean, because the reality is that I think some of Gary's writing that Art Nampersa shared was that when that quote unquote person embodied, so to speak, that awareness, it was something that people couldn't, in a sense, look directly at I don't think any of us that still look in the mirror and see a person and identify with it are ready just yet to let go of that awareness that basically dissolves the ego on contact. And I think that's why according to those accounts anyway, which kind of seems true at least symbolically, whether it was true literally or physically or not, a physical being, an oxymoron, using the word literal and physical is...
Don't confuse yourself.
Oxymoron. Anyway, but I think that's why, they're really, it would kind of make sense that people had to kind of look away, because that quality of peace, nobody can really tolerate that here. But until we practice it enough to the point where we finally get rid of our masochistic tendencies altogether, once and for all. But most of us are in that process.
We're in a process of comparison. And so if I compare myself, if I'm with Amma, who I cherish and adore, I don't, say, great, I love you, Amma, from afar. It's, I wish I was like you. That's, it's that comparison thing that goes on. That then puts me into a spiral of self-doubt and self-hatred because I don't measure up. And whether I recognize that, which I don't recognize that consciously. That is really a very unconscious thing. But, you know, when people are around people that are really in peace, all you can do is compare yourself to that and be upset because you don't match up. So, I don't really know what I'm saying other than, there is a reaction that people have, and they either love you or hate you. And, you can't even think that says anything about their state of mind because, they might be the most spiritual person in the world and working very hard on themselves, and someone very peaceful and loving comes along and all they see is how much they haven't done. They may be the angriest person in the world and someone really peaceful comes along and they just want to kill them because, you know, that you can't be that way. That's hurting me. The ego is a tricky, tricky trickster and, so bound to try to hold us into this illusion that it's going to make what is sweet taste bitter. It's going to make what is good seem terrible. You know, it's going to turn everything around.
Turn everything backwards, so we need to turn it around, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And that's, you know, what this Course in Miracles is here for. So I appreciate it and love it, and I'm grateful for it.
Yeah.
So anyway, and God thinks otherwise. Again, I love that. Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Thank you, Liz.
I see our next teachers in here yet. So I'm going to make a couple of real quick announcements. One is that the Weekend of Freedom Retreat is coming up in October. I think it's the 4th through the 7th at the Art of Living Retreat Center outside of Boone, North Carolina. So if anybody's interested in coming to that retreat, please, you know, contact me or Cheryl Kaplan at skappi3@gmail.com. And also, we'll soon have it up on our website, so you'll be able to look at that, what we're going to be doing there. We have great teachers, Maureen Muldoon, Jennifer Hadley, John Mark Stroud. John Mundy is now going to be joining us. Regina Dawn Akers, and then we'll also have Lori Coburn, and we also have Donna Marie Carey, who's going to be our musical guest. So I think that's going to be a lot of fun in North Carolina in October. And then in coming up in just a little over a year from now, which sounds like a long time, but you can start saving your money to be there, is the Course in Miracles Conference in San Francisco in February of 2018. And I will be speaking there along with Dove Fishman. Dove and I will be sharing at that conference. So, please check it out. It's on the Community Miracle Center website also. And, maybe we'll see some of y'all. Thank you, Dove. Dove has posted the link for the Art of Living Retreat Center and the registration for the Weekend of Freedom, October 5th through 8th. So, that's what's going on with me. So thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
Thank you, Lynn. And we'll see you next week. And I'll post the audio, as always, on the ACIM blog. And thanks for you, all you do, and everyone who joined us.
All right. Yes, acimblog.com is Bruce's website, and he does post this along with lots of other great talks that he does with Susan Dugan, and I think there's some with Lynn Corona, and just a lot of really great stuff on your site, Bruce. So thanks. I encourage people to go there. All right. So thank you so much, Bruce Rawls.
And we'll have a great week, all.
All right. Bye-bye, honey.
Bye for now.
Thank you.